Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of In a Click. I'm your host, Jamily Baroud, and on today's episode, I chat with media producer and scholar Amar Jean Christian to discuss Open Television, an indie TV and video platform he developed for producing and showcasing intersectional pilots and series. Currently an associate professor of communication at Northwestern University, Amar explores the convergence of television, video art, and creative research and development. I learned so much from Amar, and I hope that you do too. Enjoy. Hi there.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. My previous call I thought was an hour, and then I was like, oh, actually supposed to go to 3:30, but then it ended early, so.
That's totally fine. How has your day been otherwise?
It's been good. It's been a lot of meetings about sustainability of the OTV organization, which is good. I mean, it's like, you know, I founded this organization 5 years ago as just like an experiment, like, hey, maybe this could work. And then it's like, realizing that it's actually working is a little overwhelming, but also obviously really exciting too, you know.
Of course, it's very exciting. So from what I understand, you started the platform Open TV as a research project with the goal of centering marginalized artists and some of their original work. So naturally, I just want to start by asking you to tell us a little bit more about Open TV, but specifically how the project began and then how it's evolved since then.
Yeah, it has been a journey. OTV has been a journey. So I founded OTV, and now I have a co-founder, Elijah McKinnon, who's our executive director, in 2015, in the process of trying to finish my first book, which was also called Open TV. Mm-hmm. And I came at the Open TV concept through interviews with independent creators of their own TV shows. I asked people, some of whom became famous, like Issa Rae, like, why would you make this little indie web series for like no money, right? And put it on YouTube, put all this effort into it. And nearly everyone told me that they wanted to break into television and Hollywood, and they just couldn't break in. And what I had realized when I tried to contextualize those interviews is a number of things. One, the ways in which television shows are sold in the United States is an incredibly closed, complicated, and archaic process, wherein there's all these gatekeepers that you have to get in and then through in order to get your TV show. And it's a really aggressive funnel. You know, there are thousands of pitches every year. And so that highlighted for me the development process aspect. There was a racialized and gendered and other identities aspect of it as well, where people who are historically marginalized had a harder time getting through those gates because those systems weren't set up for them. And the corporate system in the United States really looked at these identities as marginal. So when you look at the data from like the year 2000 to the year 2012, when Scandal premiered, there really weren't any Black TV shows that were greenlit. It just wasn't happening. And that was the period in which YouTube emerged, right? So there was all these like Black web series and queer web series and Latinx web series coming up on YouTube. And I'm like, why are people doing this? And it's because they literally couldn't get a meeting in Hollywood. And even when Awkward Black Girl took off in 2012, you know, she pitched and she wasn't able to get the show sold. It wasn't until Larry Wilmore came in 2014, and after Scandal became a hit, that she was able to get that show. So I started OTV, the platform, because I realized that even as I was saying that the web was this fertile ground for innovation and thinking about how do we produce and release TV shows differently in this really small-scale, community-based way, that there wasn't infrastructures and systems set up to support that work, and that the industry wasn't going to create it on its own. So this is an opportunity for an experiment, right? That's what we do in universities, we experiment. And I wanted to create something that the marketplace wouldn't create. So it was designed as a TV channel specifically focused around intersectionality. There are TV channels based on identities in the US, of course, but they tend to be single identity, right? BET for Black people, Logo for queer people. And what happens when you're a Black queer person? Well, BET doesn't want you because they're homophobic, and Logo doesn't want you because they already have their one Black show and they canceled that show. So, yeah. You know, we wanted to be the network for them. And we weren't the first, but I think we were the first to think about intersectionality really broadly. So we focused first on Black women and Black queer LGBTQ people, but we also looked at race, disability, citizenship status, religion, et cetera, to try and build solidarity amongst people who've been marginalized, right? Because we face different struggles, but we also face similar struggles. And for me, from the scholarly side, I was like, well, if I do this in practice, I will probably just get really interesting data. It won't be generalizable necessarily, right? Because it's a very specific thing. It's a Chicago-based intersectional TV network online, but it will be really rich and deep and really give me a really interesting story to tell about the challenges for changing television, for changing social media and technology, and what value intersectionality can contribute to media and social systems. And since then, it's really taken off. And now that we're in year five, we've released over 70 projects. We've supported about as many artists, a little bit more than that. I've been pitched even more of that. We've done programs for anywhere for up to like 150 people. The industry has reached out to me, and we do programs in partnership with industry. I've helped artists sometimes get a useful meeting or their first agent through that. We've, you know, there's the awards and the nominations, and we've done so many screenings, and I think there's been healing that's happening through it. It's really been so instructive for me about the role of independent distribution and development. And specifically in the US context, we just put so much of our culture we give to corporations. And the what I've really learned that I knew going in, but I've learned in much deeper ways, is the ways in which systems outside of corporations can actually produce as much, if not more, value to the culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I do want to kind of delve into this concept of intersectionality, because I do think that you've done something that I haven't seen specifically before. I know that you talk not only about like the big three, right? So gender, race, and class. I think that those are, of course, big themes, but I also think that there are other, not taboo themes, but themes that haven't really been touched on before. And I think that this intersectional lens allows for topics that are not often discussed to be discussed. So I just want to talk about intersectionality for a second, because as you know, I also used intersectionality in my dissertation, and I found that there's a dominant argument in the literature that suggests sometimes scholars kind of inadvertently or not prioritize and hierarchize particular identity categories, but also don't grant people the opportunity to self-identify or to name their own privileges and experiences of oppression. So in your research and in the content curated on OpenTV, how do you ensure that content creators have the power to name their own social locations as higher or lower than other categories in their lives? And again, I ask because I admire what you've done. And I think in order for your vision to become more mainstream, it might be useful to kind of break down your method or formula for this praxis.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really great question. I think that intersectionality is a theoretical framework that we are still understanding 30 years after the coining of that term. And of course, we can trace the legacies of intersectionality, you know, 100 years. But, you know, once Kimberly Crenshaw sort of created that term and gave it a name, I think it really opened up a huge door that is still opening, and we're still figuring it out. And for me, I wanted to say, this is a network focused on intersectionality. We have an understanding of intersectionality as based in Black feminism. And so race and gender and class have always been key. And sexuality is usually, most scholars who talk about intersectionality will often throw in sexuality as well. But we know from sociology and just life that like there's so many different communities that we all ascribe to based on our disability, our citizenship status, our ethnicity, our religion, and possibly other things as well that we don't yet talk about or know about. And I never wanted to say these are the identities that we focus on. I wanted to say we focus on intersectionality. You tell me what that means for you. But I also would sometimes ask people questions. So there were some cases where I was pitched a show by someone who was like, let's say, a Black guy, and their show is about a Black guy. And I'd be like, well, you know, there's this theory of intersectionality that we all have these communities, these sociological categories that we're related to, and some of us are marginalized by multiple of those categories. You know, what are those identities that you think you're exploring in this work? beyond race, because we'd be talking and they'd just be talking about race. And I'd be like, well, you know, are you thinking about anything else? And sometimes people would be like, well, actually, you know, these people that I'm focusing on, you know, they've really been marginalized because they don't have access to opportunity. So I'd be like, oh, okay, well, it seems like you're talking about class, and I'd be able to like draw it out of them, right? Or, you know, this character is struggling with the fact that they had violence committed against them in the first episode. So then I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, there's a theory that trauma is actually a disability, right? It's a mental condition that actually has to be struggled with and is like a lifelong struggle. It becomes an identity, right? Being traumatized, right, by various systems. And there's a lot of ways in which sometimes like a story about anyone who's racially marginalized is like almost already intersectional because of just the natural trauma of being racialized, right?
Right, yeah.
It's about the levels of trauma, and I think it's also about the storyteller's awareness of that trauma.
Right.
And I think what we get a lot of times in Hollywood is stories about race where the trauma isn't acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And so the story isn't actually intersectional. Sometimes the creator knows that, but they don't have the language to articulate it. Or you have these executives who don't understand intersectionality and are trying to take that out of the story, and it just gets taken out, mm-hmm. right? So for me, I was really influenced by John Jackson's Real Black, Adventures in Racial Sincerity is the title of the book. And they have this theory that we think about identity as authenticity, but the framework of authenticity assumes that there is a script that can be judged, that our identities can be judged by, mm-hmm. okay, this is a Black story if it has these things, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and in America, it's like, it's gotta be urban, it's gotta be violent, it's gotta be hip hop, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and we all know once you say that, you're like, that's ridiculous. Like, there's all kinds of Black people, right? Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. And so John Jackson's theory of racial sincerity is like, sincerity is a framework that's about, I'm telling you who I am. You have the option of believing me or not. And that's a conversation that we're having, right? It's not a script. It's not something that some external adjudicator can decide yes or no. Mm-hmm. It's a conversation. It's a dialogue. It's a process. It's iterative. It constantly moves. And one of the things I love about working with artists is that they think in the complexities. Good art lives in complexity and nuance.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about television is that, unlike film, there's not a sense that the story ends. The story can just keep going, right? Yeah. Because it's life, and we can just keep exploring the complexities. So that's why I love this work for thinking through intersectionality. And, you know, on more brass tacks ways, methodologically, like in the beginning, I actually didn't ask artists about their identities at all. Mm-hmm. Like I'd never asked them to like fill out a survey and be like, tell me your identity.
Yeah, name your location. Yeah.
And then, you know, like 5 years in, when we had 70 artists, I was like, people were asking me, like, how many of your artists are this identity? And I'm like, you know what? I should probably have an answer for this. So I did eventually survey them. But we developed those surveys in collaboration with community. So the surveys would change every year. Like, we would do a survey when we would do a screening, and people would tell us, like, we'd always have opportunities for feedback, and they would say, hey, my identity wasn't on this survey, and we would just add it the next year. So like, we added different gender markers throughout the years. Like, we started with, I think, male, female, trans, masculine and feminine spectrum, and then someone asked specifically for non-binary. Mm-hmm. So we like added that, and some of the people didn't like the way we just said like trans, and then you could select trans masculine spectrum or trans man. People wanted trans women and trans men, in addition to having masculine spectrum and feminine spectrum and male, female.
Yeah.
And we made it multiple choice so people could do multiple things if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
For things that, and we always allowed open-ended for every question. So like, if the option wasn't there, you were always able to say it in your own words as well. So that was another way we allowed for that kind of dialogue to happen.
Oh, it's so tough because I mean, I love that it's complex. I think that complexity is the best part of intersectionality, and the embracing of the complexity just always makes me realize how little I know. And sometimes that can be frustrating, but other times it's really liberating to just be comfortable with not knowing everything and also be comfortable knowing that I could meet somebody who identifies in a way that I've never heard of before. And that that's really exciting to learn about that experience and learn about how that has come about. So I think that that's a brilliant way to do it. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I struggle with that in my research. I'm like, do I leave this blank so that they have the power to name their own identities, right? Because otherwise, I mean, you're always going to exclude somebody unintentionally, right? And so I think that that's a fair way to do it, just leaving it, making sure that you do your best to cover the bases, and then also asking them to give their input if they would like to. And that's incredible.
Yeah, it becomes a labor issue too, right? Because if every question is open-ended, that's the most ethical way to do it. But then you need to make sure you have the time to like process that information, mm-hmm. right? Like turn it into something that you can generalize from. Right. And there's a great article from, Lisa Boleg.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yes. Love.
Yes. On intersectional research methods. And she just talks about like, there's just a tension between generalizability mm-hmm. and the ways in which sociology requires these like definable categories that can be specified, and intersectionality, which is necessarily about the fact that like identities cannot be additive, you know, like no. It's not like a menu. So
exactly.
For me, it's just a tension, and you have to just embrace the tension.
Yeah, exactly. And which is tough for everybody, especially in this media context. I think not everyone wants to deal with that complexity. Like it might seem a bit overwhelming, but I think it really enhances everything that we do, no matter what. During my committee meeting, one of my committee members had said to me, like, why didn't you choose feminist intersectionality or like Black feminist intersectionality? Like, why do you just claim to be an intersectional scholar? And I had said to her, I don't have my participants for the study yet. And if I go in with a specific lens, say you know what I mean? I'm a feminist intersectional scholar. I know so many, specifically racialized Black women who do not identify with feminism, you know, for various reasons. And the last thing that I wanted to do was enter a research project where I'm trying to be open-minded and make sure that everyone feels comfortable and can name their own identities, but then going in with my own lens. And for me, it felt like I was claiming, like, I knew that because they were Black, that was the reason that they felt marginalized, or because they're women, that's the reason they felt marginalized. And it was a debate, you know, and like it took some time, and I'm not even sure that she really came around, but I held so strongly to that. Of course I'm a feminist, of course, you know, but I don't think that that means that everybody is. And I didn't want to shut the door on somebody who read that and was like, no, not interested in participating in this study. So it can be tricky.
Yeah. Like what if you were trying to interview someone who was maybe, you know, transmasculine, assigned female at birth, who might politically believe in feminism, but not sign up for a study about feminism because for them, transitioning to masculinity was a really important part of their identity formation, even though they might have solidarities with Black feminism or Black trans feminism.
Right.
You know, I think it's a personal thing for every scholar. You know, there are some scholars who are like, I'm a Black trans feminist.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's me. And I'm like, that's cool. Mm-hmm. For me, intersectionality, its openness and ability to expose tensions is its power. And so, you know, quite controversially, and I'm waiting for a scholar to push back on me about this, and I feel like it's coming, and I'm excited about it. But like, when you go to OTV, there are programs from white people,
right,
who are at the intersection of gender and sexuality, and maybe even disability or something, but they aren't racialized, and I don't yet know if they should be participating in conversations around intersectionality. But for me, I was like, well, I'm interested in putting this forth and saying that this is all under the umbrella of intersectionality, and seeing what the discussion is that comes out of having white people in that space, right? And like, that is how we understand, are there boundaries and borders around intersectionality, right? What are those boundaries and borders? Is it about practice and process? Is it about you can be white, but you have to create value for people who aren't white? Is it that you're white and you're just cool and you can work on the gender sexuality frames and that's cool, but you can't be in the race space? You know, like, what are the boundaries? Are there boundaries? And for me, an exploratory experiment sort of is about excavating all of that of not deciding beforehand what the thing is.
Yes, and I had realized throughout my research that that is a debate in intersectionality. It's like, do we include these like unmarked categories, or like the what about white people question, which was really quite prominent. And I had the same perspective that you did, which was, I mean, we're all people. White isn't necessarily, even if we're all right, if we're racialized white, that doesn't mean that we necessarily don't have some type of like, I don't know, differentiation from the next like racialized white person next to us. And I think that if we're going to start excluding categories, then we're simply reinforcing the system that we are trying to break. But
yeah, it's a form of policing and right. borders and boundaries, which should be opposed to intersectionality.
Yes, I completely agree. Oh, if anyone ever does come to you with an argument, I would like to know. I just want to hear what that perspective might even be and what the argument behind it might be as well. But I did struggle with that as well. And I mean, I did include racialized white women in my study, and they were also incredible. Like, I thought every aspect was so rich, and having that diversity really supported me in my learning. But also because I'm racialized white as well, it was really interesting to learn from other racialized white people, like how you navigate that space, and like how you navigate a classroom where everyone's quite diverse, but you are that white woman at the front of the class. Like, I need to hear from those people so that I learn how to be a better ally.
Yeah, and it's for me, it's been generative to have some white people involved, because for one, white people who've been on OTV end up kind of being accomplices, and they have a way in, and they have a way to support people who are racialized in different ways.
Yeah.
I've also seen how, like, a lot of people of color, including Black people, actually want to partner with white people on creative projects, right? Because they want in their story to draw contrasts, right? They also want white people to watch their story. I think for some people, maybe it is strategic in terms of like, they feel like maybe they'll have access to certain spaces if someone white is in their story, which is complicated, but real in a white supremacist capitalist context. Mm-hmm. We've had shows where it's like the leads are like two different identities and one is white, and there's no way to prove this, right? But there's the possibility that having a white person allows certain white institutions to come in and say, here's an award, here's money, et cetera.
Right.
And that supports Black people, right? So, like, I think it's complicated. I really like Jennifer Nash's book, After Intersectionality.
After Intersectionality?
Yeah, where she, as a Black feminist, says that, like, there's an impulse amongst Black feminist scholars to say that intersectionality is for Black women only, by Black women, right? Mm. And she, Jennifer Nash, is like, Black women are at the heart of intersectionality, and maybe women of color, Indigenous women, are like right there at the heart too.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe trans non-binary people, Black and Indigenous people, like right there too. But that the people who created intersectionality weren't just doing it for Black women. They wanted Black women to be centered, but they were trying to build a new world from the core of Black women, right? It was because they wanted the world to change so that they could thrive, right? And if we limited it to just Black women, we're not allowing other people in so that we can change the world, right?
Yeah.
And like, it really limits the possibilities of intersectionality. And I, that's kind of where I'm at.
I completely agree. And like you were saying before, the history of intersectionality before the term was coined, like there were many words for it, and also many women of many different cultures and races who were chatting about it. And so just because, and of course, Kimberlé Crenshaw, like queen, what a queen, you know, and I respect her work so much, but we do have to acknowledge that many women from many walks of life have been advocating for this. It's just not with the same language.
Yes. And Latinas, Indigenous women,
totally.
Women from other countries,
And so I think it's important to keep that into perspective, but also just to value and cherish each one individually, right? And like to keep that in mind. No matter what, if I'm writing the word intersectionality, I always make sure I write what came before. So we don't forget about those women as well. So after reading your book, Open TV, Innovation Beyond Hollywood and the Rise of Web Television, I've learned that you've always been an avid TV consumer. So I want to hit you with a kind of hypothetical question. So let's say you're at home, all of your work is done for the day, and you're ready to relax, unwind. I assume you drink wine, so pour a glass of wine, watch a little TV. So what do you type into the Open TV search bar at that moment?
Yeah, I mean, definitely for OTV, like, This year, unfortunately, we had a lot of the pandemic stopped a lot of our shows from completing production. We released a lot of pilots and video art, and I do want to make sure people check out Conspiracy Theorist, because I think it's really relevant to this conversation. It's an experimental pilot about a Black female graduate student who is struggling with her mental health, specifically a kind of schizophrenia. And it's just such a nuanced piece and beautifully filmed about how reality is socially constructed, and how, you know, you can be someone who's historically marginalized and feel like you're crazy, and you're actually fine, and the world is crazy, you know? It really is, it's one of the pieces that in all of our history, I think, gets at that dynamic in like the most efficient, beautiful way. And we have these beautiful video art pieces that we're going to be releasing this year that were filmed in Germany and South Africa that were like 2-day short films called Brave Futures that are just amazing. And you watch them and you're like, I can't believe you did this in 2 days. And they're so diverse. So please watch those. We have a lot of content. I think Brown Girls is a must watch on our platform. It's beautiful. It's like self-care as television. The Tea is another one. These shows, I think what we've really been able to do is like these shows about intersectional friendship of people who are really best friends and they have different identities and they support each other. We have a lot of those shows on OTV and it's something that Hollywood doesn't really do. And I'm like, now that we've done it so many times, I'm like, why don't people do this more often? Because it's such a beautiful thing to see like a Black woman and a South Asian woman, or a white trans woman and a Black queer boy, like in solidarity in their struggles together, having very different struggles but also still there for each other. Like that for me is the model of where we need to go in a society. In my own private viewing, I actually have been watching a lot more YouTube in this pandemic. And I've been really surprised by my viewing habits. I have been watching video games. Because I teach creative industries broadly. I do like a creative industry survey course. And my week on video games is always my weakest week because I don't have time to play video games. Yeah. So I've had time. I've been on sabbatical, the pandemic, you know. So I've been just, I still don't have the capacity to play video games because it stresses me out. But I will watch them as like 8 to 20 hour movies and like get a sense of like how are video game narratives structured. And it's been really wonderful. Like there's this beautiful game called Horizon Zero Dawn. Okay. That's like this post-apocalyptic kind of feminist, white feminist narrative. But it's like this woman is trying to discover like why did the world end and how did humanity survive? And it's just gorgeous. The Last of Us is a zombie narrative that's just amazing, really pleasurable as like just a viewing experience. There's lots of beautiful indie games as well. That's the newest thing for me. So there's this game called Journey that's super simple. They're almost like silent films if you just watch them. And they're really abstract, but like you can just sit and watch them and they're just beautiful. Another kind of post-apocalyptic, spiritual, surrealistic thing. I've been watching a lot of business news. I've been really getting into economics and macroeconomics because of what's happening with the economy.
Right.
So I've been learning about quantitative easing and central bank policy and things like that. Because I'm also interested in thinking through like reparations, systemic reparations for my next book, and macroeconomics and what is happening with policy right now, I think is super critical because there's a lot of capital flowing, right? Like, and there's a lot of capital that's flowing at the scale of what we need for reparations. And I'm not just talking about reparations for slavery. I'm talking about reparations for all the harm that's been done to all the communities in all industries in American history. And right now that money is just being given away to corporations. So I'm just like really following that money. I've been watching lots of Twitch. I've been watching lots of drag queen shows on Twitch.
Oh, of course, yeah.
drag queens just stay innovating and doing brilliant things, even in a pandemic. And there's been some other interesting Twitch things. There's this channel called Woke, which is just like protests from around the world, just streams constantly.
Oh, interesting.
Chicago has this organization called Experimental Sound Studio, and they've been thinking about ways to like live stream audio art on Twitch. Yeah, it's been a beautiful thing to consume media in this time.
I think so too. I'm glad you brought up video gaming because it's not particularly my forte. I don't love playing video games, but I have been watching my partner play Grand Theft Auto here and there. And it's been really interesting to see what type of community is built online. And also just during this kind of next wave of Black Lives Matter, seeing people online become more aware and like debates happening. Like if you like put the headset in and there's full on debates and like there is racism for sure, but I've noticed a lot more of allyship, and that's been really beautiful and exciting. Even very young people speaking back and speaking out. And there was even like a Black Lives Matter protest in the game, and like a moment of silence in the game as well, after a multiple of the deaths that occurred. And I just didn't realize that there was such a deep connection between what was happening in the real world and happening online. And it was kind of beautiful to see that come together. And even if I am playing, like if there's like an 8-year-old on the other line, you know, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I'll be like, what button do I push, you know? And then he literally was just like, this is what you do, you know, like the sweetest, kindest kid, was so patient with me. Like I just didn't I didn't know that like there that this community existed in this way. It was really mind-blowing for me, and I still don't love playing. Like it's not something I want to do in my free time, but I do think that it would be interesting, like you said, to incorporate in like an educational context, because I think that there is a lot to learn from it, and it would be ignorant of me not to know what's going on when so many people are involved in it and invested in it. So I'm glad you said that. It's cool. One of the questions I want to ask you too is just like, obviously I have not been immune to the challenges of COVID, but the impact in Hollywood, it seems, has been massive. So movie releases getting pushed and sets completely shut down. And so I'm wondering for you, what have been some of the challenges in general, but also sort of some of the creative ideas or approaches that have been used on OTV to just like keep the ball rolling and stay on track?
We have too been affected by it, even though our productions tend to be much smaller than Hollywood productions, so presumably a little bit more safe, there's a little less risk with less people on set. We have advised most of our artists to not film in the pandemic. Here in Chicago, we have opened up now, and our daily caseload is quite low, and we're pretty ramped up on testing. So we do have a couple productions that are heading back into production right now. We have a set of guidelines for artists. We're encouraging people to film outside, which is safer. We are encouraging people to set up their productions and have the crew be able to leave and then send actors in. We have remote shooting guidelines. So we do have a set of like things you can do just from your own home in terms of filming. And this is actually happening at the bigger level too. Like Netflix just released something, I forget what it was called, but it's a series of short films from big directors who basically filmed in their homes alone without a crew. And I looked at the trailer and it looks like people did really amazing things. So you can do a lot in your home.
Agreed.
You can definitely do things that are more vlog based. Animation is possible. You can get actors to, you know, record remotely, and you know, things like podcasting are obviously much more safe as well. So we've, in some cases, encouraged people to just not even work in video and just work in audio only. Mm-hmm. We did a 3-day queer pride festival that was like 3 nights, and that was all basically shot in our studio with like really, really small crews. Green screens.
Nice.
You know, once we did music sets where we just have one singer and a microphone and we mix in the audio afterwards, like the backup afterwards, or we had people make like experimental video art pieces from found footage or things that they shot with their phone. We did like a little mini film school this year that we were going to do in person, but we moved to Zoom.
Oh, cool.
And that was really good. Some people taught from their homes, but we also were able to open up our studio and basically have the lighting set up just like done already, so that even if you weren't trained in production, you just flip a couple switches. We have instructions for setup, and like you can teach your class in like a professionally lit with nice sound situation for us. So there are ways in which we're trying to do that, but I do think, like so many other industries, film is about bringing people together. And in order for us to tell the kinds of stories that we're known for, we have to be able to have a grip on this pandemic. And I know that you're in Canada, and I think your government has been better about this than ours have, because I've talked to executives who are like, we're not filming in the US, but we're filming in Vancouver.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, Chicago has been pretty good just as the state, but the US is, we're such a state-run place, like it's gonna depend on how all the other states do, and if our federal government can get its act together, which seems unlikely before November.
Yeah.
So we will see, but we're able to do, I mean, we've always released experimental work, and you know, so we'll be able to do that, and we'll be able to host live streams that give people access to information and release that experimental work. So we'll be around, we'll be doing things no matter what, but we would like the society to get itself together so that we can do more ambitious productions for sure.
Yeah, of course.
Quite difficult.
Yeah. Well, if you need Vancouver, you have a place to stay.
Okay.
Come on over. You'll love it here. Okay, so we're just about out of time, but before I let you go, on the show we play a game called Hot Fire Fill in the Blanks. So basically, I start the sentence and you finish it if you're ready to play.
Cool.
Yeah, okay.
Ready.
So, my dream artist to work with, either in the past or present, would be...
Oh my God, like five names just went to my head. Okay.
There's no rules.
Oh, there's no rules. We can do
You can
like
pick five if you want to, totally.
Okay. Terrence Nance, Ava DuVernay, Issa Rae. I'll stop there. There's so many. It's like, it's a crime, but those are some of the top.
No, I just want, we'll put it out in the universe and hope it happens. If I had a magic power, it would be?
Ooh, I would want perfect memory so that I could like read all the books and remember every single word and just like make my brain into a library.
Ooh. I'm writing a book chapter right now about nanotechnologies, and basically there's this new innovation within 20 years or less, there will be a brain chip that you can literally put into the back of your head, and it would be like that. You would literally have access to all, you would have YouTube in your brain or like Google in your brain. It's actually quite intense. So once I'm done that article, I'll send it to you. You'll learn all about it, but it could be possible one day.
Wow.
Yeah. If I could remake any movie and star in it, it would be...
Okay, I'm not much of an actor. Again, too many answers. But you know what movie just popped into my head that would be great as a remake, especially in this pandemic? Boys in the Band. This is a gay movie from the 1970s. It's mostly white gay men, and they're like trapped in an apartment, and they're like horrible to each other, and they talk, and they're catty. I would love to do that, but make it queer and intersectional, so it's not just white gay men, and it's like different kinds of queer people trapped in an apartment, and they have to like figure out all their issues.
I love this concept. Yeah, this is a good idea. Okay. And the last one is one way to shine light online is, and so I asked that question because of a philosopher, Stiegler. He was just saying, in order to understand the internet, you have to attend to like the lights and the shadows. So one way to shine light online is?
Creating art. Yeah, I think. And really thinking about it as art, not just as like a video you want people to watch and laugh at and like share, but like actually a really beautiful story to like interject with all the pain and suffering that we're seeing online right now.
Yeah, oh, that's a great answer. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this with me.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun to chat with you.
It's been really fun to chat.
Awesome.
And good luck with everything.
Thank you
so much.
Take
care. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I'd love to hear what you think and anything more or less that you'd like to learn about. Comment here, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jamilee.baroud, jamilee.baroud. Until next time, shine light online, and I'll talk to you soon.